This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Usually joining us in this space is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, but he's doing a little bit of recovery this week, so we wish Colin a very speedy recovery and all the best. Feel better soon. So joining us instead in his seat today is Bilal Sakhu. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. Hello there, Bilal.
Good morning.
And also with us is Christine Stewart. She's editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning.
And joining us as well is Dan Haar. He's editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Danny.
Good morning. Great to be here.
There's a lot to talk about, and we're going to start with the State of the Union. The address last night, President Trump stood before a legion of female Democrats, all wearing white. And though, he got their groans on more than one occasion, he also had them leaping to their feet and cheering at moments like this.
All Americans can be proud that we have more women in the workforce than ever before. Don't sit yet. You're going to like this.
And he said some more things that they did like afterward. However, female Democrats weren't necessarily in the same celebratory mood. Here's one of them, Connecticut U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro.
It was shameless in terms of what he did on being divisive about the wall and scaring people.
And that's really what this speech was all about. It went on praising war veterans at times, a famous astronaut, a young cancer survivor, to telling Democrats he couldn't work with them if they continued the war of investigations against him. At one moment, late in the speech, he pivoted hard from a plan to fund childhood cancer research, straight to school choice, right to paid family leave, and finally to late-term abortion, ending with this line, "And we must always keep faith in America's destiny that one nation under God must be the hope and the promise and the light and the glory amongst all the nations of the world." So, Bilal Sakhu, there is a lot in that speech, and I don't think I've ever heard a State of the Union that went back so quickly back and forth between one idea and the next. Right. It wasn't a Clintonian series of policy pronouncements, things that I will do that perhaps I don't know how I'm going to pay for. But it was a series of things said, some to appease and to reach across the aisle, and some to scare in a typical Trumpian fashion. Right. What did you make of it?
I think in many ways it was an effort to launch his 2020 campaign. I think what he tried to do was to, you know, cover the landscape and say, here are my accomplishments. He talked a little bit about some of everything. You know, for me watching it, I felt like it was really unfocused because it was all over the place. And he'd give a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I'm sure Republicans, and the sort of establishment Republicans were happy to hear him talk about the economy and talk about the economic numbers, I think. But he sort of fell back into those things that really appealed to the base. I mean, he talked a lot about immigration. He demonized undocumented immigrants. He sort of did the usual spiel with regard to that. He talked a lot about the wall. And so from that standpoint, I really think it was an effort to really launch his 2020 campaign.
But in a different way than he has talked politically from the stump before, because he's in front of this new group of congresswomen, right, an awful lot of them. And he wasn't acknowledging in the way that past presidents have whenever they've taken a licking in midterms that things have changed. He doesn't tend to do that. But he said an awful lot of things that I think some Republicans aren't terribly happy with. Right. At one point, praising our military strength. At another point, saying we shouldn't be in so many wars. Right. And on it went. It seemed for every idea that he had that was going to appeal to his base, there was another idea that seemed to suggest that he was looking for some other audience.
I mean, a lot of the commentary about his speech last night has talked about how he, you know, sort of presented those fig leaves to Democrats and said, here are a few things that we can give you. But the reality of it is that he spent a lot of time talking about immigration. But he talked about infrastructure, but it was, as you know, if you blinked, you missed the entire conversation about infrastructure. And so while he sort of flagged a few things, he didn't really go into depth on those issues. And I think the bigger issues that really frame that talk are the ones that the Democrats have the hardest time with.
Christine?
So there was a lot of there wasn't a lot of specificity. I mean, you know, so he said he wants to get rid of childhood cancer. And he actually did put a dollar amount towards that. So there seems to be some sort of policy proposal behind that.
$500 million.
Right, the $500 million. He said he wants to create a national paid family medical leave program. No details. You know, he mentioned, he said the words infrastructure four times, but gave no details. So the things that the Democrats and he could agree on, there were no real policy ideas that were fleshed out. He seemed to be trying to convince them again on the immigration issue that, you know, he got a chance to speak to them and address them. And I don't think he's going to win over any of them.
I think another one of the interesting things, as Bilal said, about the speech being a little bit all over the place is when he says this state of our country is strong and then goes into a crisis at the border and then goes into crumbling infrastructure. Those are if indeed we have a crisis at the border, if indeed we have a crumbling infrastructure, that would suggest a nation that is not strong at all, a nation that perhaps is falling apart in front of our faces.
No, that's true. And I think, like, you know, so he just said things like school choice. We need more school choice. So I don't know what that means or, you know, how to even proceed with that. So I'm not sure what to make of it.
Danny?
This is a president who's in hot water, and he knows it. And as the late, great Bob Dole said, the American people know it. And this is driving a lot of what he's saying. I see no reason, if he were to be impeached, I see no reason for the Senate to clear him on that, depending on the charges, if the charges are warranted, because they will have at that point nothing to gain by exonerating him. He knows this, and so he has to sound softer, but he can't do it. And so I just want to talk really quickly about two things. Paid family leave, we know what he's going to do because he already proposed it, I believe, twice, certainly once in his first year, a smaller program paid for by the states. That's what he's proposing, which I think is a good thing. And it's better to have the federal government set a standard. They do that in lots of things, in the environment and lots of other things. But we know that it's going to be a relatively small program. And we also know that he's not going to expend any political capital on it, which he did not in the first 2 years when he did support it, as he did during the campaign. Secondly, on the infrastructure, same thing. We know that he wants the ratio to go way down from 80% federal to as low as 20% federally paid, and that to be picked up by either private-public partnerships, which are really big tolls, in other words, on highways, or by the states themselves. So there's no dedication to an infrastructure program the way we know it.
And that's really important to point out. When he last floated the idea of big infrastructure investments, you know, the next day we're all looking and saying, he's actually saying we're going to spend less at the federal level on infrastructure than we're currently spending. And so it would suggest, Andy, that will continue to move forward.
It's like one of these employers of ours, which we've all had do. If we're fortunate that we've had this, we go from a defined benefit retirement plan to a defined contribution plan where they're going to give you way less money. And they say, we're giving you choice and we're giving you this money. And they present it as we're giving you something, but it's the opposite.
I just thought it was interesting that he did mention the investigation. So here's what he said. He said, if there's going to be peace in legislation, there cannot be war in investigation. So he did mention it. He did kind of make a plea that, you know, hey,
is that
guys,
a couplet? I don't know enough about poetry.
I don't know.
It was actually, he doesn't rhyme very much.
Everybody was quoting Johnny Cochran on CNN.
That's exactly. It sounded very Johnny Cochran-esque. Well, and I wanted to ask you about that, but also, I mean, he does make the point pretty clearly that he wants these investigations to go away. I think it's pretty clear just viewing not only the face of Nancy Pelosi last night, but her words since election night, that's probably not likely to happen. And so those investigations will go forward in full force.
Yeah, I think the Democrats are going to go forward with these investigations. And I think this is going to be something that will drag out probably for the next 2 years if the Mueller report doesn't sort of push them very quickly towards, you know, an impeachment. My sense is that this has been great fundraising for the Democratic Party. It's great in terms of mobilizing the base. And I think that the Democrats are going to push forward with it regardless of what the president feels. But before I sort of finish, let me sort of go back to something you talked about earlier about the image, in the House. I thought it was a very powerful, powerful image to see all of those women in the House dressed in white. you know, marking the 100th anniversary that the 19th Amendment was actually introduced in Congress and then sent to the states to be ratified a year later, of course. It's a very powerful image because you look at that side of the aisle and the diversity there with regard to women, people of color, Muslims, Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos. It's sent a very powerful message about one part of our nation that is growing, that part of the nation that is increasingly being reflected in the Democratic Party. You stare to the left, and what you saw was a mostly white, mostly male, mostly middle-aged and older crowd of people. And I thought that was such a powerful contrast between the two parties, where they're at. And then all of that gets capped off by Stacey Abrams' speech at the very end, which I sort of expected her to drop the mic when she finished. I thought it was so good.
I should say that one of the striking moments to me, Christine, was the way in which the chant USA, USA was co-opted by this group of congressional female Democrats later in the speech. And there was something really telling in the little clip that we played before that although, yes, many Democrats stood and cheered at the appropriate times, and they sat down with their hands folded at, I'm sure, the appropriate times for them, there was quite a little bit of pushing back. Like, now's not the time when you're supposed to stand and cheer, but we're going to stand and cheer anyway. So there's a little bit of that friction in there as well.
No, definitely. I think that there was one point where Bilal and I were like, this is going to go on for a very long time because
our Twitter feeds.
People kept standing up and cheering, yeah. And I was like, and it actually, I just want to let people know that it actually was not the longest State of the Union address. The longest belongs to former President Bill Clinton. So he made it was close. It was about 3 minutes short.
He came in
3 minutes
second, though.
Shy.
Clinton had number one and two, so he passed Clinton's second
he
place.
He did pass Clinton's
so
second
now,
place.
It's so. Now one... Two, three, you know, Clinton is 1-3 and he's 2. So he's jumped, and he's got, what is it, one more or two more? I don't know how
two
many.
Two more to go.
Is it two? Well, after the election.
Yeah.
So, oh, that's right, he does have two. I do think it's worth noting that I'm in the camp of people who think that the response should be specific, right, on these. I think it's sort of a bad habit for America to come in and say, we're going to have one sort of effusive speech by the president, which is the president's right, and have the Democratic response to be equally sort of symbolic and abstract and effusive. I think the response should be really specific. Things like, he said this, but this is the case. And I think she did a great job, but I don't think that should be the job of the response. To that end, I just really quickly want to give some numbers. This unprecedented economic miracle that he talked about, which all other economic booms have been stopped by simply time and cycles, and he doesn't seem to recognize that. He has averaged 203,000 jobs per month in his first 24 months. The last 24 months under Obama were 212,000. There's almost no way to measure this boom and call it unprecedented. The 90s just absolutely blew this stuff away. On unemployment, he's brought it from 4.7 to 4, and the last 2 years of Obama were from 5.7 to 4.7. There have been more manufacturing jobs created under Trump. That's true. Pay for workers is higher, but that's because unemployment has continued to fall and for no other reason.
Yeah, a lot of the big numbers in there, too, are about numbers of women in the workforce, number of African Americans in the workforce. Look, there's more people in
the
country.
There's more women. There's more women. So that
more women
actually,
unemployed.
Yeah, well, there were actually more women in the workforce in the year 2000. There was roughly 60%. We're at 57.5% at the moment.
Mm. I wanted to, before we take a break, Bilal, mention the other big story of this week that the president kind of touches on, the incredible saga of what's going on in the State House of Virginia. The governor, Ralph Northam, there being asked to resign by Democrats, by Republicans right. alike. He has so far resisted. The lieutenant governor now perhaps in some hot water of his own. What is happening in the state of Virginia? And what could or should we take away from that as far as the state of the Democratic Party, really the state of politics in America right now?
What's happening in Virginia is that it's a hot mess right now. I think, you know, the allegations now being launched against the lieutenant governor just makes this even more difficult in terms of how the Democratic Party and how I think people of the state of Virginia moves forward. I think what this has really brought to the surface is really just the deep, deep problems that race has presented for our society over the years, many things that we've buried. When we think about race problems and race relation problems in our country, we talk always about places like Alabama, places like Mississippi, who have a well-earned reputation for being problematic on the issue of race. But states like Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and other states in the South also have their own history of race and bad issues around race, as well as many states in the North as well. And so I'm just amazed that he did something like this in the year 1984. I'm amazed that he still is not really explaining himself. I think he is attempting to really dodge the issue of why he did that and to really talk about the kind of person he was at that time. I don't think you earned the nickname Coon Man because they heard you tell a coon joke on one occasion. That's a nickname you earn. Most nicknames people get, they earn them. And I think he earned that because he regularly did those kinds of things. And I think he needs to come to an account for that.
And again, having gone through the entire issue with the Supreme Court nominee and what he may or may not have done in high school or college, we're talking about this is a med school yearbook. This is a fully formed person. I guess I'm wondering, Dan, one of the things that has been interesting to me, though, is whenever this happens, there's this call to rush to get everyone to denounce this. Ned Lamont has so far stopped short of asking the governor to resign. I mean, does it matter? Does everyone have to pile on and say and take a position? He must step down now.
Well, I mean, there's a line that has to be drawn, and the nation is looking for that line. What Bilal said, we're still groping for this, both on race and on sexual harassment.
Yeah.
Certainly sexual assault is a zero tolerance, but in this case, in the case of the lieutenant governor, the Washington Post investigated it at great length. And I thought it was notable that when the Washington Post said we investigated this and found it to be nothing, he still said that you've unfairly targeted me, which I think that sort of illustrates how confusing this is. The Democratic National Chairman last night did call for him to resign. I don't know whether he had done it earlier, Perez. I don't know whether he had done it earlier. But it really is – I mean, at a certain point, you get to a Kirsten Gillibrand problem, which is because of what she did with Al Franken, many, 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 many Democrats will never vote for her. There's no – it's a never Kirsten movement because she went too far on that one.
I'm going to take a break. When we come back, there's a lot more to talk about, including what's happening at Connecticut's Capitol right now. Ned Lamont's got a budget speech coming up. He's already been talking about things he wants to do during his first term as governor. Democrats are laying out some of their agenda items. That's similarly all over the place. We're talking with Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join the conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. We're also on Facebook Live today. You can watch us at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're here with Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and today Bilal Sakhu, associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. Colin McEnroe is off this week. Well, in most years, today would be the day the governor comes out with his budget proposal. But because he's a bit new to the job, Governor Ned Lamont has a 2-week extension. He's probably going to use just about every minute of it figuring out his tax plan. Well, Dan Haar, let's start with you. What are some of the big things that are going to happen, especially on tax reform, you think, with this governor and this legislature?
Well, we're going to probably first of all, I would say that the shortfall for the first year is down to $1.45 billion, I would say, which is still a big number. But in just three short months with two new reports, it's down by $600 million or so, 550. So it's getting smaller, and that's a good thing. We are likely to see the hospital tax, which we don't have in any number of segments time to go into here in how it works. But suffice to say, it has to be renewed, and it's going to save $400 million off of that 1.4 because the budget proposal now, I mean, the forecast now assumes that sunsets, it ends.
This is the trick where we get money from the federal government and it says
Right. It's a trick where you tax hospitals, give the money back, and you get extra money from the federal government. That's $400 million.
We are
likely to see about $175 million of tax credits that are supposed to go into effect, not go into effect. They would be delayed. There are some other things in that mix, but there are some changes in the tax bill to the tune of about $150 million. That's fairly likely, I would say, to be delayed. Lamont will be accused of a tax increase, and we're going to debate whether that's a tax increase when the when a tax decrease or a credit was supposed to go into effect. We are likely to see about Christine may correct me on this. I'm guessing about $200 million in lapses, meaning money that they say we're going to cut just by not spending it and without targeting it, and real cuts, that combination.
I mean, I would agree with that. I think that the hospital tax is going to be a big one to see how the Lamont administration. Remember, the Malloy administration had an adversarial relationship with the hospitals because the OPM secretary Ben Barnes said, you know, why do we tax hospitals? Because, you know, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. So I think that the Lamont administration is trying to repair that. But there's this also this lawsuit going on at the same time where they've been this lawsuit since 2016 where they've been challenging Connecticut's taxing scheme. So, I guess we'll have to find out what happens to that. I think people are probably more interested in the grocery tax and whether, you know, Lamont is going to be taxing groceries. And I don't believe that is going to happen.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit last week, Danny. The chances of a grocery tax broadly based, probably not that good. It seems like a trial balloon that was floated
popped.
For a reason.
The only question about the grocery tax is whether it was a trial balloon or an unintentional someone in the process unintentionally put it out, and that Lamont himself would not have said put it out. But he did fairly quickly. I shouldn't say fairly quickly because he let it go a week. But a week later, he did say to me and others, and actually just to me, that it was not in the top 50, which means that since you don't have 50 new ideas in a budget, it's not happening.
And well, you know, when you slip and fall and you're embarrassed by it, you try to pretend that you meant to do that.
Yeah, he was going to hope it was going to go away.
But, you know, for me, the interesting question, when I'll be being unable to dive as deep as the two of you are into the budget, but the interesting question for me is listening to, well, a couple things. Listening to what both of you said, the numbers still don't add up. So how do you get there to really deal with these issues? Will be interesting to see how this new governor works his way through that. The question I have for the two of you is, do you get the sense that there is actually a stomach to really dive deep into the way Connecticut does its taxes in the state and to really try to reform that effort?
It's the only way that they're going to be able to get there. I mean, I think that they're going to look to broaden the sales tax base by removing about $750 million in exemptions.
I don't know if they'll go that far.
I think they will.
That's a big nut.
It is a big nut.
That's equal. $750 million is equal to about 1.3% increase as if in the tax, if it were to go from 6.35 to 7.6.
Right.
That's not what they're going to do. By broadening, they're just going to tax more things, but it's equivalent to that. So
right.
That's a big number. I don't know if they're going to go that far. They also, the estate and gift tax is, there's a very, very broad agreement on the Democrat side as well as obviously the Republicans to either end or greatly curtail that tax. It's viewed, it raises about $150 million a year. It goes way up and down. It's viewed as hurting the state because people don't want to die here. I also think that there's a the property tax is a harder one to do, to your point about true reform. Senator Looney, the Senate president, has a proposal to make all cars taxed by the state rather than the towns. That's not tax reform. That's just shifting. That's not property tax reform. That's shifting money. There is a stomach to do it. The problem is it's really, really hard, and it takes a long time.
Yeah, and I can only imagine towns don't necessarily like that idea all that much. before we have to take a break, Christine, though, at the same time as this, you know, like Democrats who have bigger majorities in both the House and the Senate, they're coming out with all their priorities. And it sort of feels like there's the budget plan that Ned Lamont has. The Democratic priorities, as I've seen them laid out, sort of feel like that speech last night. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. We'll do some of this. We'll do some of that. What stands out to you in all the long series of Democratic legislative priorities right now?
Well, what stands out is that they don't necessarily agree. So the House and the Senate Democrats don't necessarily agree on what their priorities should be. They agree on about a handful of priorities. But other than that, the Senate Democratic Caucus has continued to have press conferences About their own priorities, which don't necessarily match up with the House Democrats. Right. So I think we're going to see some intra-party fighting.
I mean, I think for me, I'm pretty excited and happy to see some of the things that the Democrats have laid out as priorities. I think the idea of raising the minimum wage is something that needs to be done in our state. I'm sure the president will claim that that growth in income will be a result of his administration and not the hard work that people have been putting in for years to try to push these that kind of legislation across the country. I like the idea of the voting reforms. It's in there as well. I'm a big advocate of early voting. I'm the, you know, the chair of the board for Common Cause in Connecticut, and that's a big issue for us that we've been pushing for a number of years. And so I'd like to see that pass. I like the idea of paid family leave. And so there's some things in there that I like as, you know, someone who's on the left, you know, that looks at that budget and hopes the state will move in that direction. But I think there are some real challenges around the budget, and that's what really scares me, because that will put pressure on public spending on many programs that people need.
Go ahead.
Yeah, paid family leave. The problem with that is it's essentially a payroll tax of 0.5%. And do we want the average Connecticut household to pay $400 or $500 more for that benefit? That's just really a big question.
That's their initial. I think that they're going to be able to get paid family medical leave over the finish line this year. I think what's interesting is the argument against the increase in the minimum wage from Republicans, in that if you make $15 an hour, you're not going to be able to get subsidized programming from the state.
Yeah, the minimum wage is tied to the estate tax by some people, including the majority leader, Matt Ritter. So that should
that
fly.
That may be the trade-off. That should fly. I think you're right. Yeah.
We're hearing from Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Bilal Sakhu from the University of Hartford. Right now we're going to hear from some of my colleagues, and they're going to tell you how you can support all the great things that you hear on WNPR. We bring you shows like The Wheelhouse because you've asked for them, because you've paid for them in the past. But now I'm going to ask you to give generously so that we can continue this programming into the future. Here are a few of my colleagues to tell you how. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. We're also on Facebook Live today at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us is Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford.
Go
Christine
Hawks.
Stewart, Editor-in-Chief. I didn't say it this time. I usually say Go Hawks for you. Go Hawks. Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Go CTNewsJunkie.com. And Dan Haar, Editor and Columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. And go Hearst Connecticut Media. Danny, we'll start with you very quickly. Ned Lamont has unveiled a new economic development team, including David Layman, head of global real estate finance at Goldman Sachs. And he like reached out to Ned Lamont and said, I want this job. These are people who didn't actually know each other before.
He was inspired. They both do live in Greenwich, like everyone else in this administration. But he was inspired by the State of the State speech, actually, on January 9th. He watched it and was moved by it, which was a nice, moving speech. And he said, I want to help. And, you know, this seems to be a pretty good thing. I understand that there are rumors about who was supposed to be the DECD commissioner, and there was a short list. But he got the job. He was a wunderkind on Wall Street. He was head of structured finance by age 28 or 29, I believe, certainly by 29. And structured finance is the business that, got us into all that trouble. But it's the super, super credit default swaps and super complicated deals. He was the head of that at age 29.
Can we circle back to that, Dan? I mean, if people remember him at all, they may remember this wunderkind testifying in front of Congress
2010.
About how Goldman Sachs and the rest of Wall Street and big banks kind of conspired to put together all of these strange derivatives and things that ended up sinking the economy for a number of years. I mean, I'm not pinning it on this gentleman. What I'm saying is he seems to understand that well enough to know that that's part of what got us into a gigantic amount of hot water.
A big part of that testimony was the committee questioning him and his chief financial officer on, well, wait a minute, Goldman was making money when everyone else was losing money because you had these deals that required collateral drops? And they said, well, yes and no, because for every deal that they lost money, they were making money. That they made money, they were also losing because they were hedging their bets. And so the question was, did you lose an equal amount or were you making money when everyone else was losing money? And the answer was, we'll get back to you. And the answer is ultimately Goldman. But I don't think that's a bad thing to have the person who engineered that. I don't think it's quite let us say that it was hardball economics and finance. To have that person be your head of economic development ain't so bad.
do the skills translate, though? I mean, you know, understanding structured deals and finance and investment, does that translate to attracting businesses to expand and grow in Connecticut?
I think he's smart enough to analyze that you should stop giving $30 million a year to retailers because it doesn't pay and it's stupid. And he'll figure that out. A third grader could figure it out too, but he's really smart and he'll figure it out quicker.
Well, there's no, I mean, there is no commitment to continue the Small Business Express program or the First Five program.
Small Business Express, you have to divide, you have to divide those programs into those investments to companies that are doing something that's bringing in money from the outside and those that aren't.
I mean, my general reaction is pox on the house of anyone who gave us credit default swaps or any of that. So those exotic sort of instruments that Wall Street created that the regulators didn't understand, that most of the people who were on Wall Street really didn't understand, but they were cashing in the bucks. And so they didn't care until it almost caused the you know, Great Depression, you know, in a modern era. And so I'll actually wait to see what, you know, what he and the former CEO of Pepsi and
Indra Nooyi,
right, and that he sort of has brought together as a part of his team. He made no promise to drain the swamp. And so from that standpoint, I can't hold him accountable for going and tapping the various, you know, same core people who we normally get doing these kinds of roles. And so,
but wait a minute, all she did was grow Pepsi from $35 billion to $65 billion by becoming one of the most international companies
We can do an entire episode just on Pepsi.
Okay, so skipping by Pepsi or Coke.
I was just going to say what's also might be interesting to listeners is that all of these people in economic development are volunteers. They're not taking a salary. So they're doing this for the state as a public service to the state.
And they were going to make how much if they had taken a salary? $150,000, $200,000?
Well, I think a Department of Economic Development, probably around $170,000, $180,000.
Yeah. The other two jobs are
voluntary. Which is a rounding error.
The other two jobs are voluntary. Yeah. Jim Smith from Webster. Yeah. And Indra Nooyi.
Those are new positions, chair. Voluntary.
Those are board chair positions. Those are not executive positions.
Okay, so let's skip ahead to another story. In terms of people taking other jobs, and Dan, I want to go back to you on this one. We hear this week that George Jepson, former attorney general, taking a new job with Shipman & Goodwin, the big law firm, along with his deputy. Now, they're going to start a new line of business for Shipman & Goodwin. And in terms of this is how perhaps I'm projecting my own thoughts on this, people who maybe aren't in the right position. One of the things that Mr. Jepson, who I like an awful lot, is going to go do is he's going to start a new line of business in which the former attorney general is going to work at times with other attorneys general around the country to try to litigate against big corporations, and then maybe also defend some of those big corporations that are facing lawsuits from attorneys general across the state. Do I have that right, Dan? Is that what the gig is?
Well, that's right. This is a new area that big law firms, some big law firms are getting into. This is the first in Connecticut at Shipman & Goodwin. Perry Zinn Rothorn was the top deputy under George Jepson, and they are the partners in this. I asked Perry yesterday who's the boss, and he said, well, if there were a hierarchy, I would treat George as the boss, but they're partners. And they do have a plan to very carefully go about, because obviously there are going to be conflicts, and you can't have conflicts, to go about, outsourcing work for attorneys general, B, consulting with attorneys general on strategy, because these are two guys who did a lot of big picture stuff. There were an awful lot of multi-state. Jepson, in contrast to his predecessor, Dick Blumenthal, Senator Richard Blumenthal, was a lot less confrontational and a lot more given to negotiation. That makes him a lot higher, more employable in his current ambition. They also are, as you said, going to represent companies that are being adjudicated by attorneys general.
From a good governance standpoint, Bilal, should we feel concerned about this sort of thing?
I mean, on the one hand, I think, you know, the former attorney general has a right to earn a living. But I think this really sounds a lot like the kind of revolving door that we do, in fact, complain about when it comes to people who work in the military and make their way into private industry and utilize some of the relationships they've been able to build in their previous job. And so I think it still needs to be fleshed out in terms of what exactly he will be doing and how he'll go about doing it. But it's sort of an interesting transition for him in terms of the kind of work he's doing.
They're going beyond what the law says in Connecticut. They can represent clients before courts against the Attorney General's office. And they're saying they're unlikely to do that in the first year, that they're going beyond what the law says they have to do.
Okay, so we do feats of strength and airing of grievances at the end of the program, and I'm going to start with mine. I'm going to turn to Christine for mine, because we've both been following a story this week. Some legislation was proposed by one state senator, one state representative, that would, in essence, have completely crippled a burgeoning new industry here in the state, craft brewing. It used to be, you know, a dozen craft brewers in the state of Connecticut. Now it's like 80 or something like that. This is a huge number. And the legislation that was put forward by Brandon McGee and Doug McCrory would have taken that its legs out. I mean, what were they trying to do?
Well, I'm not sure if they know exactly what they were trying to do. So they introduced this legislation that would have asked the craft brewers to separate their business, to give up part of their business, either give up their tap room or give off their off-site distribution. Many of them would have to close. I think the craft brewing industry is up to about 11,000 employees in the state of Connecticut. I'm not quite clear why either of these lawmakers decided that this was good legislation to introduce.
Well, what was interesting is they introduced a Brandon McGee, who is also now running for the mayor of Hartford job. He said, "I didn't know people cared so much about beer. I can tell you."
That was my favorite line. I was going to use it.
if you watch, say, the Super Bowl.
I should have given you the audio in advance. I do want the audio.
You would have noted that people do indeed like beer, and people actually care about beer a lot. I think that a lot of the pushback, which came very, very fiercely from people who are part of this industry and really got them to pull these bills back, came from the idea that, these two guys, Doug McCrory in particular, have gotten a little bit of campaign money in the past from beer distributors, people who really want to be able to sell to both bars and also to liquor stores. They want to be able to get their beverages out, and they see these brewers as a big competition for them.
I guess they see them as competition, but I don't understand, because the distribution business for the big companies, like Anheuser-Busch and things like that, they're million-dollar businesses, and they are not, these craft brewers, it's not even close comparison. So I guess they were upset that they didn't make as much money. But you know what? Consumers don't want that beer anymore.
Yeah. The distributors and the package stores together have an enormous amount, not so much the distributors. But remember, I asked Carol Hughes, the lobbyist for the package stores, I said, how do you keep doing this year after year? And he says, there are multiple package stores in every house district, and these are people in your neighborhood, and that has a lot of influence.
I'm a big advocate of public financing of elections, and so to me, this problem of whether it's, a direct result of the kind of money you get from particular contributors to your campaign or not, for me, if we have public financing of elections, we can eliminate some of these kinds of problems.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been easy back in the day to say, Doug McCrory got money from distributors, but is, $250 amounting to $1,300 from a few distributors really going to make a difference and influence legislation?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. $1,300, I think, is the amount of money that came out this week that Brandon McGee owes on his back taxes for. Is that right?
That is funny. That is true.
It's the same number. We don't have time to get into that. I feel, Bilal, like I'm full of grievances today, and we only have a couple minutes left in the program. So I'm going to go to you first. Yeah. Do you have a feat of strength or perhaps a grievance of your own?
The only grievance I have is against the New England Patriot fans. And the reason I have a grievance against them, I'm from Detroit, and I've won one playoff game in my entire lifetime, and it's killing me. I need my Lions to win the Super Bowl. I just need them to do it. I know some of my friends are going to hear me admit this over the radio. I'm a hater. I admit it. I hate
you have
the Patriots.
You have a former Patriots coach in charge now, right?
Yeah, but he's not doing it yet. I got to get a Super Bowl in before my life. I know what the Red Sox fans feel like right now.
Is that where Matt Patricia went?
Yeah, he's in Detroit.
Okay, I forgot that.
So maybe it's a good year for the Tigers this year. So spring training just a couple of weeks
away. That's my hope.
Christine, how about you?
You know, I just want to give a shout out to Emily Woodward Tracy and Kevin Tracy. I mean, what an amazing run at Get Baked Bakery in Windsor.
Absolutely.
7 years they created. Not only did they have a business there, but they also created this sense of community that was just amazing. And so I'm going to be really sad to see them go.
For people who don't know, tell us a little bit more about the business, because there are businesses like this that go and come all the time. But I know this place as well, and I know these people.
Yeah. So Get Baked was a bakery in Windsor, right next to the train station, which is seeing a revival from, you know, the new Hartford line. And they have all sorts of, you know, cupcakes and goodies and cookies and things like that. But they also had this sense of community. They did pop-up markets and they offered up their space for very little to the community to use.
Yeah, I've now been in Connecticut long enough to have seen many people succeed in business, and then those businesses close down after 7, 8, 10 years. And I've been through a couple of those cycles myself recently with friends, and it really is a feat of strength to be able to do that at that level for
definitely.
Such a long time. So kudos to them, and best wishes on their next endeavor. How about you, Danny?
Sticking to the beer theme and the nutrition theme, the plethora of breweries, 90, I believe, in the state of Connecticut is a great
90.
Thing.
Wow.
Lots of choice in beer. That's a great feat of strength for Connecticut, and I think the rest of the nation. My grievance is that you still can't get a true face-cringing, throat-squeezing bitter like you can in London. the American IPAs are still too sweet. I don't know, someone's going to call me and say there's a true bitter out there, but I don't think I've found it yet.
Can I just say, I was at Norbrook Farm Brewery out of my neck of the woods out in Colebrook. You can cross-country ski on 400 miles of farm acreage there. There's paths through the woods. It's an amazing place. There's all these breweries popping up in really, really cool places. So, yes, kudos to brewers. Kudos to Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Thank you so much, Danny.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And thanks to Bilal Sakhu, associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. Thank you so much, sir.
Go Hawks.
The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Kion Wolf is our technical producer. Now I'm going to turn things over to some colleagues who are going to tell you why you should support WNPR and how you can support everything you hear on Connecticut Public Radio.